Chapter 1. First the end, then the beginning. I left New Zealand in 1975 and didn't return to live here until 1996. I spent 20 years working overseas as a Christian aid worker, using my nursing and midwifery skills in Australia, Vanuatu, Thailand, Somalia, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Kenya, India, Zambia, Tanzania, and Mozambique. During those years, I also spent time in England, completing a variety of courses, including tropical medicine, planning for disaster, refugee health, and finally, a master's degree in medical anthropology. I returned home in 1996 because I received a death threat while in Mozambique as part of a World Vision development team. My role was to oversee the World Vision medical contribution to this program, which was operating in the Tete region of Mozambique, in partnership with the Mozambican Ministry of Health. I remember arriving in Mozambique in January 1996 and driving through the city of Tete and seeing a surprising number of people with only one leg or no legs, using crutches. I asked Rashid, the World Vision team leader who had collected me from the airport, what had happened. He explained this was because thousands of Mozambican citizens had been severely injured by accidentally stepping on the thousands of landmines laid throughout Mozambique during the civil war. Hundreds more had been killed by landmines. Specialized demining teams were working in Mozambique, trying to locate the landmines and defuse them. In 2015, Mozambique was declared free of landmines, with over 171,100 landmines having been removed. Let me share some background on Mozambique. The Portuguese sailor, Vasco da Gama, arrived in Mozambique in 1498, and a gradual process of colonization took place over the next 500 or so years. In 1962, exiled activists met in Tanzania to form the Mozambique Liberation Front, Frelimo, headed by Eduardo Mondlane. In 1964, Frelimo forces started a war of independence, and in 1975, Mozambique finally gained its independence. The Frelimo party ruled under a single-party system when Samora Machel, the leader of the Frelimo party, became president. In 1976, RENAMO, an anti-Frelimo resistance group, was set up by Rhodesian officers, and clashes began to occur with the Frelimo in Mozambique. From 1977 to 1992, there was ongoing civil war between Frelimo and RENAMO. In 1986, the Mozambican president Samora Machel was killed in an unexplained plane crash in South Africa. Fighting ended in 1992 and the country's first multi-party elections were held in 1994. In 1995, Mozambique joined the British Commonwealth. An estimated 1 million Mozambicans died in the fighting or from starvation during the civil war. My home for the next 2 years was to be Tete, a city of over 1 million people on the Zambezi River in the Tietia province of Mozambique. Tietia was over 1,000 kilometres from Maputo, the capital city of Mozambique, where the World Vision National Office was located. Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, was only 338 kilometres away, so it was easier to go and buy supplies there rather than driving for days to Maputo. I was working with a 7-member team of expat, experienced aid workers, and a team of Mozambican nationals, including medical staff, logistics staff, agricultural staff, drivers, and guards. Given my inability to learn foreign languages, despite a 3-week course in Portuguese, I was thrilled to find that John, administrator of the World Vision Mozambique Medical Program, was fluent in English. He also had a wealth of knowledge and was very willing to guide me in all aspects of the culture, language and history of Mozambique, as well as giving me the background of the World Vision medical program, which we would be working together on. I lived in a small 2-bedroom house on a World Vision compound in Tete, along with 5 other WV workers who lived in other houses on the compound. The compound had a high fence around it with armed guards. Our team leader Rashid and his wife, both from India, lived nearby in another small compound. And then one day, everything changed. My world turned upside down one Saturday morning in June 1996. I was sitting at my dining table, drinking a leisurely cup of coffee and planning activities for the coming weeks. I'd been in the country 6 months and was enjoying working with the World Vision Mozambique medical team, as together we were planning to address some of the major health concerns facing the tier-tier regions: ongoing and increasing malnutrition, the need to re-establish vaccination programs after 17 years of civil war, and the need to upskill local staff who had gone through many years of a brutal civil war. There was also a huge need to teach mothers how to read and write, which was the focus of one of the programs that I was involved in. My Saturday morning, usually a time for rest and relaxation after a busy week, was interrupted by a loud knock at the door. I found the armed guard who protected our compound standing there. "Bom dia!" "Good morning" in Portuguese, he said, to which I replied, "Bom dia," as he handed me a white envelope. "Obrigado." "Thank you," I said, shutting the door. I sat down to open the letter, handwritten on a single sheet of white paper, with the following words: "Unless you and your senior Mozambican staff raise the salaries of the Mozambique health staff, you and your senior Mozambican staff will be killed at the end of the year." "Surely this is a joke," I thought. Stunned, I read and reread the letter. Why would someone send me a death threat? I had felt truly called by God to work alongside Mozambican people and help rebuild their medical programs after years of civil war. I was also aware that many Mozambicans held the perception that all expatriates had money. World Vision, along with several international aid agencies, meet regularly to discuss wages for local staff to ensure that what they were being paid was fair, depending on the different work they were involved in. So why was I being targeted when I wasn't the one who set the salaries of staff? Suddenly, I felt very alone in this war-ravaged country. Thoughts were racing through my mind. My emotions ran high. I felt angry, fearful, anxious, and worried all at the same time. Had I offended someone? 1,001 thoughts began swirling around in my mind. I needed to talk to someone. I decided to show the letter to my expatriate colleague, Anne, who lived next door. I knocked on her door and she welcomed me in. "Read this," I said, shoving the letter at her. She looked at me, realizing that this was serious. Anne's mouth fell open as she read the message. "Oh, Barbara," she said, "this is awful," giving me a reassuring hug. We sat in silence, trying to decide what to do. "Let's drive over to Rashid's place and show him the letter," Anne suggested. Rashid and his wife lived nearby on another small World Vision compound. Our Land Cruiser was parked on our compound, and we asked the driver to take us to Rashid's house. A few minutes later, we arrived at their house and were duly invited in. Rashid and Anika sat us down and offered us a cold drink, before asking, "What can we do for you?" Wordlessly, I passed the letter to Rashid. Glancing at me questioningly, he took the note. A look of shock crossed his face and he came over and hugged me. "I am sorry, Barbara, that you have received this. We will support you through this, I promise." I knew he would, but suddenly I felt panicky and tearful. The threat was beginning to feel very real. "I'll increase security on the compound and inform the World Vision National Director in Maputo," Rashid assured me, "and I'll contact the local police." After a time of prayer, the driver took Anne and me back to the compound. The following night, at our weekly expat staff meeting, Rashid informed our 7-member team of the death threat. As a senior member of the World Vision team, John was also invited to come that night. We decided that this situation would remain within the four walls of the house and wouldn't be discussed amongst the local staff. Rashid urged us to be vigilant and to report any concerns to him without delay. My colleagues rallied around me, offering their support, and the evening ended with prayer. I struggled to sleep that night and for many months to come. The smallest noise unnerved me, and I never felt safe. Questions tormented me. Did one of the medical team write the letter? Or was it someone who had a grudge against World Vision? It wasn't only directed at me, but also at our senior Mozambican staff. Why? Would they really carry out the threat? And if so, how? Waves of fear washed over me. I became suspicious of everyone, and my nerves were frayed. It was also very hard for John, as he was the most senior Mozambican staff member on our team. The death threat included him as well. On the Monday following that eventful Saturday morning, Rashid and John went to see the Tete chief of police and informed him of the note. A few days later, he came to see me and asked for names of possible suspects. John was present at the meeting. I thought about it, felt that a reply could place me in even more danger, and refused to supply a list of names. After some discussion, it was decided that the police would interview all World Vision Mozambican medical staff over the coming days. The police chief who had come to see me asked us to provide writing pads, pens, and a light bulb before the interviews could start. He explained that such supplies were needed to conduct the interviews. I could understand the pads and pens, but the light bulb? He explained that the light bulb and room that they were using for the interviews had broken and they didn't have the money to buy a replacement. This didn't exactly fill me with confidence. Despite all of this, both John and I continued to lead the medical team. I found the weekly team meetings very hard as we discussed the upcoming work plans. Still, the question haunted me. Which one of you wrote the death threat? Weeks ticked by, and the police seemed to have lost interest in my case. When Rashid asked the police for an update, they told him the case was ongoing. Soon, months had ticked by. In my many years as a humanitarian relief worker, I had never broken a contract, and I desperately wanted to continue in my role as manager of the World Vision Medical Program and complete the projects in Mozambique. But with the death threat hanging over me, I felt uncertain. As the months passed and I became increasingly conscious that the end of the year was looming, tension mounted, accompanied by unhurried police investigations. But I forced myself to be patient and work with the police, as I was a guest in their country after all. I didn't write home to my parents about this situation, as I didn't want to worry them. John and I continued to work with the team, and I spent time travelling with the Mozambique staff, visiting the various World Vision feeding centres which had been set up in some of the poorer areas of Tete province. Because these feeding centres were in very remote areas, access to them was limited due to roads near the feeding centres not yet having been cleared of landmines. To visit one such feeding centre, we had to cross over the border into Malawi, then drive the length of Malawi and cross back into Tete province to access a major mine-free road to the feeding centre. If we were late in reaching the border crossing, we had to sleep at the border in our land cruisers. This happened on more than one occasion. Many of the clinics I oversaw were on the more minor roads, which may or may not have been checked yet by the demining teams. As these teams cleared each road, signs would be erected on the side of the road, informing everyone that the road was safe. So we relied on the driver to ensure that these roads had been demined. A lot of the travel that I did was in very remote areas, and if we had a toilet stop, we didn't wander off into the bushes on the side of the road, as we couldn't be sure if that area had been checked for landmines. This added to the excitement of the work, to say the least. An update from the police. After several months, the local police finally got back to Rashid and me, informing us they had interviewed all the staff members and hadn't found the letter writer. They said the only way to find out was to arrest them all and beat a confession out of them. This seemed barbaric to me. Perhaps this was something that happened in this part of the world, but I chose to say no. The next comment from the police chief absolutely astounded me. "You're the only person we haven't interviewed," he declared, and ordered me to come to the station the following morning for an interview. "You must be joking," I thought. I complied, insisting that John needed to be with me for any interview, as I didn't have enough Portuguese. The police chief met us at the station the next morning. "I want to interview you alone," he informed me. Come with me to the interview room. I need my colleague John to come with me and translate, I insisted. I have very little Portuguese and I need John. The police chief refused point blank. You must come with me alone, he stated, slightly raising his voice. We had reached a stalemate. Again, I told him I wouldn't be interviewed without John. The police chief and John started a dialogue in Portuguese. I couldn't understand a word they said, but it was obvious that neither of them was prepared to back down. The police chief was furious and again ordered me to come with him. I looked at my colleague with tear-filled eyes and refused to move. The police chief stormed off, uttering a few angry words. John and I were driven back to the World Vision office, which was on the edge of town, and there I met with our team leader, Rashid. We discussed what to do next. We obviously weren't going to get any more help from the police. I had conflicting emotions and felt ambivalent. When I arrived in Mozambique, I had signed a 2-year contract, and here I was, wanting to walk away from the job after just 6 months. I also didn't want to let down the people of New Zealand, who so generously supported the work of World Vision in Mozambique by donating money and supporting events like the annual 40-hour famine. I'd spoken to the New Zealand High Commissioner, who was based in Harare, Zimbabwe, about a project which I was hoping to start in a very poor part of Te Te province. We wanted to set up a project that involved gathering women and their young toddlers together, feeding the children with high-energy porridge, and running literacy classes for the women, which would include reading and writing. He was very supportive of this project and helped fund it. I hated the thought of abandoning this and other projects I'd initiated. Another project which I was involved investing in the Mozambican World Vision staff. Mozambique had joined the British Commonwealth in 1995, and there was a huge interest in learning English. Our staff were very keen to learn, and I had arranged for Nick and Lucy, the grown children of Sheila and Roger, friends from Liverpool, to come and teach. Despite my worry over the project's future, having Nick and Lucy staying with me helped to take my mind off the death threat hanging over me. As time passed, the end of the year was coming closer, and the storm clouds seemed to grow larger and blacker. I wasn't coping well, and I knew something had to change. I had to wonder whether, if I left, the projects I had set up would continue, or if all my efforts would be wasted. I forced myself to go to work each day, commit to these projects, and patiently wait for the police to come up with something. By early November, the situation was becoming untenable. I was losing sleep at night and felt I couldn't trust anyone. The letter had said I would be killed by the end of the year unless senior staff received a pay increase. The end of the year was only 1 month away. Things turned around after I phoned World Vision New Zealand director, Colin Prentice. He rang Bruce McConchie, a fellow New Zealander who was then the director of World Vision Southern Africa. I felt somewhat relieved when Colin suggested that I give Bruce a ring. Bruce and I had worked together in Tanzania. He knew me well, and he knew that I was someone who was normally very strong, having gone through some tough times during my aid worker journey. Later that day, I phoned and shared with him what had happened. Bruce voiced his concerns about the death threat that I had received and ongoing stress it was causing me, and asked me to come to South Africa to meet with him. He made arrangements for this to happen, and the next day, a Friday, I was driven to Harare and flown to South Africa. Bruce met me at Johannesburg, and we went to the World Vision office. He listened quietly as I explained the situation and finally said, Barbara, we need to get you out of Mozambique as quickly as possible. We developed a plan. I was to fly back to Harare on Saturday. The World Vision driver would collect me and drive me back to Te Te, and I would go to work on Monday morning as if nothing had happened. The expats on the team would be informed, but not the Mozambican staff, which included John. I really struggled with this decision, as we had worked so closely together, but I felt I needed to abide by what Bruce had arranged. On Monday morning, I went to the office and continued with my work, hoping no one would notice my inner turmoil. I knew I had to leave Mozambique for my own safety and sanity, but it was an incredibly hard thing to do. Working in African countries, I'd learnt that farewells were extremely important, as they gave the person leaving a chance to say goodbye and to ask forgiveness for any wrongs they had done, and vice versa. Now I was leaving without saying goodbye. Walking out on John and the team felt like a betrayal. I knew he would be hurt, as I would be if the situation was reversed. I left the office late afternoon and climbed into the waiting Land Cruiser. My heart ached as we entered the compound gate for the very last time. I walked into my house and found that Mary, my housegirl, had just finished preparing my dinner. I thanked her and signalled I didn't require dinner tomorrow night as I was going out. She probably thought I was going out to one of my colleagues' homes for dinner. But I knew I was going out and leaving Mozambique, never to return. Mary said goodbye and left the house. I never saw Mary again. I ate the dinner she had prepared and started to pack my one suitcase. I fought back the tears as I was sad to be leaving, but also relieved, knowing as I did every moment of every day that the end of the year was fast approaching. Later that evening, my expatriate colleagues came to say goodbye, and they kindly sent my belongings back to New Zealand some months later. I spent a restless night trying to process the events of the last few months. When I'd arrived in Mozambique, I'd decided this would possibly be my last overseas assignment. After nearly 20 years of relief and development work overseas, frequently in desperate conditions and coping daily with suffering and despair, I'd begun to think seriously about heading back to New Zealand. Working in such tough conditions over so many years had taken its toll on me physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. But I had no idea what I would do or how would I adjust to life back in New Zealand. So many questions. My faith in God was a bit shaky just then. Walking away without completing my contract was gut-wrenching. I'd never broken a contract before and felt I'd somehow failed. Not being able to say goodbye and thank people was even tougher. Many times I asked God, why? I was deeply distressed that God's early call for me to be a nurse midwife aid worker was ending this way. At 6 the following morning, my driver arrived as planned. I loaded my one suitcase in the vehicle and was driven to Harare. From there I flew to London to stay with friends, Pat and Jean. Pat had spent several years working in Afghanistan as a nurse midwife, but was now a mission director living in England. We had first met in Banu, Pakistan, many years earlier, and she had extensive experience in providing support to people who had had similar experiences to mine. I trusted her and respected her wisdom and guidance. I also really appreciated the pastoral and spiritual support she gave me then, before I began my journey home. Because I was employed by World Vision International at this time, I was asked to fly home via the World Vision International head office in California, where I met with World Vision staff experienced in counseling and support. I also spent time with the World Vision security team, who reviewed what had happened and looked at what could have been done differently. I was advised not to return to Mozambique. Some weeks later, I returned to New Zealand, still traumatized by these events. My return signalled the end of my career as nurse, midwife, aid worker. Just as I arrived back in New Zealand, Cheryl Thayer, a Red Cross nurse from Southland, was killed in Chechnya, just shy of her 40th birthday. There but for the grace of God go I thought. Since I left Mozambique in 1996, 6 expats have been killed there. Some were workers, some were visitors. Until the 1990s, aid workers were rarely killed, but today this is becoming increasingly common as mercenaries, insurgents, and political activists realize they can use aid workers to put pressure on governments and gain publicity for their cause. Previously, aid workers had a kind of diplomatic immunity because they were going into desperate situations and laying down their lives for people in need. Whenever I hear of another aid worker being killed, I shudder and think, why wasn't it me? And I quietly thank God it wasn't. When I came home, I wondered if I could have done something differently, and what would have happened if I'd stayed. Did I overreact to the death threat? Hindsight is very useful, and I can look back now and know deep down that leaving Mozambique at that time was the right decision for me. As I jumped into the Land Cruiser that day in November 1996, I left that country knowing that by working in partnership with the Mozambican Ministry of Health, with the wonderful support from my colleague John, we did make a difference in the lives of some people. I returned to New Zealand exhausted. Nearly 21 years of working in what was often very challenging and heartbreaking situations had taken its toll. I needed time just to be. Time to spend time with my family, especially getting to know new members of my family who had arrived while I was away. Time with my friends who had supported me over those years. But most importantly, time just to be still and acknowledge and give thanks to God. He had been with me throughout my journey, from when I was a 13-year-old country girl, and as a new journey began to unfold for me in New Zealand, I trusted him to guide me into this next stage of my life. So, how did this New Zealand girl, born in a small town in 1951, end up getting a death threat and being evacuated out of Mozambique in 1996? To find out, I invite you to travel with me on my journey as the story unfolds.